Hello and welcome to episode 14 of the Thinking Poker Podcast. I'm Nate Mavis. With me is Andrew Brokus. I'm looking forward to the show today. We're going to continue some of last week's strategy discussion, and we're also going to have a talk with Zach Elwood, who's written a new book called Reading Poker Tells. We're also planning to talk about the book for a while before the interview. Want to do that now, Andrew?
I do like the idea of discussing it, especially because I think you have legitimate disagreements about the content of the book that are worth airing.
Yeah, I mean, I guess now that I've slept on it for a couple days, possibly this is just me being biased by the fact that he seems like a nice guy or whatever, but like, it seems easy enough to get the good material out of the book and then like not be sort of distracted by the bad sort of generalizations he makes.
That's mostly what it is. I think it's more, I mean, he makes some broad claims that might not be entirely right. That was how I interpreted a lot of what you said about the book. Was it more like if you take every word that he wrote literally, there's some stuff in there that's probably not true, but I don't know that the book in general really encourages you to take that literally.
That's the thing. It's just that you start off the book and then you hear something like use tells on the river in big situations. On the flop, you just play fundamental poker or something like that.
Yeah.
So first off, that's like internally contradictory with other things he says. And second of all, that's just a terrible bit of advice. That's not a matter of taking something too literally. That's just reading what he says, you know? I mean, hopefully you forget it after you read the rest of the book. And I mean, I probably would have if I hadn't written it down. But I mean, that's just not good.
Yeah, I mean, I guess what I mean by taking it too literally isn't that like it's not what he said. Yeah. It's more whether it's really what he's. I mean, I guess it's kind of doing him the favor of reading between the lines a little bit and saying like, do you think he really means that? And based on what appears elsewhere in the book, I think that he doesn't. Which is, I mean, it's sloppy writing to be sure, but I don't know. I don't think it necessarily makes the book like unvaluable or even undermines the value of the book all that much. Because I mean, at least for me, like that line in the book barely. I mean, I remember seeing it, but it didn't like jump out at me as something all that important or something that really shaped the way I thought about the rest of the book.
I guess I'm less confident than you are, maybe, that I can predict how people will react to a book and take things out of it. I mean, it's pretty
prominent.
That's the
point. We can tell them how to react to it.
Yeah, yeah. There's enough good material to outweigh any mistakes there are. It's just I really wouldn't want anyone taking everything that's in there too seriously, you know? If I'm going to unqualifiedly recommend a book, I want there not to be major errors in it. And I think that the bulk of Zach's book is really good. I think he's a lot better than his competition when it comes to figuring out why people exhibit the tells that they do. The problem that I see with the book is in its introductory chapter where Zach tries to bring it all together into a more comprehensive framework. And then he just says some things that aren't true and in fact could be just very, very damaging if you take them seriously. So I would recommend the book if I could also give with it a guide how to read the book. I mean, I think there's good information. I think anyone would benefit from reading it. I would just be scared to, let's say I had a student, I would feel a little bit of trepidation about just dropping the book off at his doorstep and asking him to read it without any sort of advance.
Well, I think that's one of the functions of a review, though, is not just to just say, like, buy or don't buy this book, but also to say, you know, here's how to read this book, or here's what is and isn't worth taking out of this book, or here's how you ought to interpret certain things that you find in this book. And I don't want to seem like I'm too much up Zach's ass. I mean, I like the book, and I'm more, I guess, like, playing devil's advocate or playing the role of Zach's defense attorney here. But I would say that the comment that you've addressed of using tells mostly on the river as opposed to on flop decisions, yeah. I do think that that's true for one type of tell. I mean, he talks about a couple different sorts of tells, some of which are based on people giving away the fact that they're not very interested in the pot, like just looking to your left and being able to notice either from the way they're holding cards or from other things that you're doing that certain players are or are not planning on continuing if any money goes into the pot. And that sort of tell is probably more valuable in small pots. You know, and he does talk about people, as the pot gets bigger, as it becomes a heads up pot, people are a lot more conscious about not giving off those sorts of tells. So that sort of thing, I think, is going to be less effective on the river and more effective pre-flop and on the flop. And then he also talks about the category of tells that have to do with people starting to get anxious because of the size and importance of the pot, where they're betraying certain things because they have a strong opinion about what they want you to do. They have a strong opinion about what they've just done in terms of betting or what they're waiting for you to do in terms of whether you're going to bet, precisely because they're invested in the pot, they give off different sorts of tells. And I do think it's true that those sorts of tells you're more likely to see in large pots, and large pots are more likely to happen on the river. I think all of that is true.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's right. But with this major qualification that, I mean, are those really the most reliable kinds of tells you get? I mean, I get a lot of the information that I get just from how somebody makes a continuation bet, like whether they're just following through or whether they're betting for some other reason. And although it's true that there's a category of tells that you're going to get more on the river than on other streets, I would also want some justification for why those are somehow the most profitable or the most important or reliable or whatever category of tells. I mean, maybe this is
I don't think they are. And I think it would be a mistake for people to come away from the book thinking that they are. And I guess I would say if you're interpreting him to be saying that, then, you know, that would be a mistake on his part to be saying that. But I do think if you sort of, I mean, I know it's a little stranger to say, like, ignore that line in a book.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think if you take it with a grain of salt and say, you know, for a certain type of tell, it's true that it does not appear very much on the flop, and it appears a lot more often in big river pots or in big river decisions, it's a pretty reliable tell. And I mean, precisely because the pot is large and it's a somewhat reliable tell, it's very useful in that spot. And I mean, it enables you to make a good decision when a lot of money is on the line. Whether or not that makes it the most valuable tell, you know, I don't think is really that important.
That's right. And
granted, he shouldn't say it if it's not true, but I don't think it's like that. I don't think it's really that meaningful to say, like, this is the most important sort of tell that there is, or this is the most valuable sort of tell that there is. I'm not even sure that's really a meaningful question.
Yeah. I mean, I guess if you want my like bottom line evaluation of the book, it's that it's good. He was kind enough to share a review copy with me. If he hadn't been, I would be happy to buy it and spend money on it. But basically, I would be looking at it for his very articulate and thoughtful analyses of different specific tells, and I would basically ignore a lot of what he says about theory, especially the introductory comments about the general principles that underwrite them. So like on page 49, when he says that reading poker tells is primarily about sensing fear and the absence of fear. I mean, that's another thing that's inconsistent with other things that he says and straightforwardly false and would be very damaging to you if you took it too seriously. Now, if I hadn't been taking notes as I was reading, I probably would have just forgotten it. But
yeah, that's what happened with me. I think you read this more closely than I did.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure the average reader would get a lot out of it. I would worry that the average reader might also get some damaging information. There was this sort of scarring experience that I had where I was a guy sitting to my left at a poker table said that Annie Duke says that suited connectors are not profitable or something like that. So he never plays suited connectors. So I mean, you just never know what people are going to latch on to.
But I mean, people also latch on to things that authors never even say.
Yeah. I mean,
you know, like I don't think that authors can necessarily be blamed for every dumb thing that's attributed to them.
Exactly. I mean, for somebody who's a fan of Foucault, certainly it's you must.
Right.
Yeah. That's it. Jesus. But Zach clearly is saying some of these things, and it's admirable that he's trying to not just give the sort of first order information that he's learned, but also to make some sort of introductory general comments underwriting them. And in fact, a lot of the introductory general comments that he has are salutary and useful, you know, things about how, you know, you should always be looking for context and always be looking other things equal to have some independent confirmation that something means something from this player. You know, people's motivations are different from other people's, and they're different from their own on different days. So, you know, so I think a lot of those comments are in fact useful, but
yeah,
some of them are not and may in fact be damaging. And so I guess that's the red flag that I would want
to let people know about. Yeah. I mean, I will say also that I think I like that he's making the effort to have the kind of introductory material that you're talking about. And because I feel like so many poker books, and we'll talk a little bit about this with Zach during the interview itself. But I think so many poker books out there just sort of a regurgitation of information in not much order, where they're just sort of like, here's a play you can make, here's another play you can make, here's a thing I did one time, without any like organization or much of a thesis to them, that I guess I'm less inclined to really to give Zach too much shit over the fact that he erred too far in the other direction, maybe by making, trying to generalize too much or make too many sweeping claims, because it does also bother me when books don't do that at all, when they just kind of try to throw out unconnected information. And I mean, it is hard to make claims about poker. You have to strike a balance anytime you're talking about poker strategy. You have to strike a balance between trying to keep it somewhat simple, especially when you're intending your book for a pretty wide audience and not necessarily only the most sophisticated players, but then also wanting to be complete and accurate without having a ton of asterisks and except in this case, but then not in this other case. There's so many exceptions. It's so hard to make generalizations that I guess I'm inclined to be a little forgiving of generalizations that are over sweeping.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's not really something that I see done well in many books.
No, that's right. That's right.
The other one that I think handles it in a decent way is Andrew Seidman's book, Beluga Whale. I wrote a review of it on my blog a little while ago, but he makes, I think, really good use of footnotes to, you know, where he'll make some claims and it doesn't really interrupt the flow because you can choose to follow the footnote or not. But if you do follow the footnote, then he'll give a little more qualification or say, you know, that may not be true in these types of circumstances, but you can kind of read it through. If you just want the bigger claims and aren't so concerned about the exceptions, you can just read through the book. And then you can also, if you want the extra detail, you can choose to follow the footnotes. I thought that was a pretty good way of handling that problem.
No, I'm a great lover of footnotes.
as is our hero, David Foster Wallace.
Yeah, that's right.
End notes, I guess, for him.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, sometimes footnotes.
Yeah.
I mean, my problem is not so much with over breadth as just falsity, but your point is well taken. And I do think this book is exceptional in a lot of ways among poker books. It shows that syndrome we've talked about, you know, here are 17 things that you can do that will make you make $100 an hour at poker. I mean, there's none of that there. And he clearly put a lot of time into the prose. I mean, the book is very intelligible. It's easy to read. It's easy to understand. I mean, the only reason I'm even in a position to criticize some of the claims he was making is because I could understand them easily the first time around. And it's been well edited. I could probably count the grammatical errors that I remember on one hand, which is a very rare thing for a poker book.
Yeah, he actually has some writing talent, which isn't something you see that often in poker books.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it's not florid. It's not any of that. It's just good, clean prose, which, especially if you're talking about return on your time investment spent reading it, it really helps because you're not spending all that time going back to the sentence and trying to figure out what the verb is or something like this. So I think I'll stick with my initial assessment, which is that, you know, I can recommend it, but with qualifications. You know, I do think it's worth the average listener's money, but you know, be careful and focus more on the first order information. And And, you know, certainly listen to the interview, right?
Right, yeah. And I actually have a quick example hand, because I did go to the casino a few times and focused on trying to use some of the information in that book. And it just gave me a new category of stuff to look for, or a new incentive to look for these things, and also some ideas about how to get your opponents to give off some of the tells that you should be looking for, which wasn't something I never thought too much about how to induce tells from my opponents before. Right. And one point that he makes that I like is just to pause a second, and, you know, look at your opponent and give them a chance to do something. Like if you just act instantly, you never even give your opponent a chance to give away any information. So just the fact of pausing and, you know, actually making the effort to look and to give your opponent an opportunity to engage you can be helpful. Mm-hmm. And there was one point where the details of the hand aren't even really that important. I can't claim to remember them that well, but I was facing a all-in decision on the turn. I think I had an overpair, and my opponent, who's a pretty tight player, had made like a big, he had check called the flop, and then he made a big check raise all-in on the turn, and like a straight draw got there. It wasn't like an overly coordinated board. I was pretty confident he wasn't on a draw, so it's just a question of like, was he sick of my aggression and overvaluing top pair, or was he... had he been trapping me, or did he just turn a straight? Like those are the concerns.
Sure.
And it was basically like a pot sized check raise for 120 big blinds or something. It was a big pot, and pots of that size don't go down that often in this casino. So his range is probably not like what it theoretically should be.
Sure.
So I was kind of thinking about what I wanted to do, and I probably was going to fold anyway. I told him like I uncapped my cards, and I was like, well, I guess I'm going to give you this one. And but I didn't actually fold it. You know, I just said that. And then, you know, at that point, he kind of sat up and he was like, I'll take it. You know, I'll gladly take it, or something like that. And just, I mean, A, it demonstrates a level of confidence that he's willing to talk at all.
Yeah.
But B, when you make clear that you're about to do something, especially like you're about to fold, anyone who's bluffing is extremely unlikely to speak up in that case. Because if they believe that you're about to fold, talking can only have the effect of causing you not to fold.
Yeah.
You know, like you're going to do what they want you to do anyway, so they don't want to mess with that or throw you off course.
Yeah.
So the fact that he was willing to talk, I mean, I think that's the indication that he didn't want me to fold.
I mean, plus just sort of Caro 101, he's basically telling you in a veiled way that he's weak, so he's probably not. So,
yeah. I don't think it matters that much what he said there. Like the fact that he's willing to say or do anything is important. Like no matter what he said there, I think I would have folded.
I don't disagree with that, but surely it's relevant that what he said is basically that he's weak. Good. So Zach's book, 2 thumbs up, 1.5 thumbs up, something like that.
Yeah, I'm going to give it to him myself.
Yeah.
I do agree that the things that you say are important things for people to keep in mind, but it's not sufficient for me to want to give it less than 2 thumbs up. I think it's one of the better poker books I've read.
Wait, you get both the thumbs? I mean, the Siskel and Ebert thing is where each of them get one thumb. So,
okay. So you're the... Well, he's getting... All right.
Yeah.
Zach gets my thumb.
Okay, my thumb is up. Okay, two thumbs up. Last week we were talking about completing from the small blind, then that got us into some discussion of, you know, when you might think that one person's range is stronger than another's generally. And so we wanted to talk about that a little bit more this week. It'll make more sense if you've heard last week's episode, but if you haven't, it should make plenty of sense no matter what.
Maybe just to recap quickly, that we're talking about a proposal that Sauce123 made in a Lego poker video. A listener named Jens submitted this question to us about whether it could be correct for the small blind to open limp or fold, you know, to never open raise from the small blind. If it folds to you in the small blind, either open limp and then, you know, sometimes call, sometimes re-raise, sometimes fold if the big blind raises. And, but, you know, with maybe 30% of your hands, just open fold and not have an open raising range at all.
Yeah.
Is the question that we're discussing, or the topic that we're discussing.
So here's like another application of the same kind of thinking, which is I find myself in 2-5 live games sometimes, less often these days, but still pretty often, where it's going to get raised behind me if I limp from early position very often, probably more than 70% of the time. And so this question arises, which is, what hands would I ever want to open raise with in that kind of a game? I often adjust to this by not having an open raising range, except maybe a few hands that I want to limit the field with. You know, I had like ace-jack offsuit. I'm not sure it's right, but yeah, I'll probably open raise, and then I get a lot more information by both from a theory perspective than just practically the way they call a raise. I can often get a lot of physical information from. So if I had like ace-jack or ace-queen or, you know, nines or something, well, maybe not nines, but certainly had like ace-jack or ace-queen, I might still raise with. But especially with my default play with a hand like ace-king will be to limp re-raise.
Yeah, that sounds right.
I mean, do you think that's correct? I mean, it seems to me that if I knew that it was going to get raised behind me, I would have almost no reason to open raise myself. And if it were nine perfect computers and one drunk guy that was going to raise it 100% of the time, I mean, I don't think the perfect computers would ever do anything other than fold or limp to the drunk guy.
Yeah, I actually played with that drunk guy 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
Who was raising 80% of hands. And yeah, there was, it was actually interesting to see people who did not adapt by open limping strong hands. But actually, I think I even mentioned that a little bit on the podcast. But the one scenario that I can think of where you might want to open raise would actually, interestingly, be with hands that aren't as strong. You mentioned ace-queen and ace-jack, and I can see one reason for wanting to open raise those, which would be that if you believe your opponent is going to three-bet the hands that dominate you and call with hands that don't, then you might actually be better off raise-folding and having the information that your opponent has, like aces or kings or ace-king, versus if you just limp and call a raise, then if you think he'll call with hands worse than ace-queen and three-bet hands that are better, then you never really have to worry about ending up being dominated, or you get the information when he has the kind of hand you really don't want him to have and you can fold, versus if he has like a mixed range when you limp and call, yeah, that could end up being worse for you. So I think that's one interesting point. And the other might actually be hands where you're trying to see the flop cheaply. If your raise is going to be smaller than your opponent's raise. So let's say that you have pocket twos and you know that you're going to call a raise of, you know, like any raise that your opponent is likely to make, you're going to call, but you would prefer that he make a smaller raise so you could see the flop more cheaply. I could imagine in that scenario, if you open to $15 and he'll have a very tight raising range, or a very tight three betting range rather, that could be better than if you open limp and then he raises to $30 or $35.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes.
But those are both somewhat contrived scenarios.
Yeah, and then even with the ace-jack, the problem, of course, is that ace-jack is awesome against really wide ranges. So certainly in some situations I've been in where the raising machine has been very near my left, it becomes too good to limp, and then wait for the raise to come, and then see how people react, and then make the decision to fold, call, or raise once it gets back to you. I mean, it can just be... Because, again, often you can tell by how the other people call, like, how strong they are, right? So if the raising machine is close to my left, then limp re-raising becomes an awesome play if I'm pretty sure that nobody's, you know, trapping with ace-king or something like that.
Yeah,
so you run into some of the same problems.
Yeah, that actually reminds me of what I think is one of the potential... We talked about how this might be a more... open limping from the small blind might be a more theoretically correct play from a game theory perspective, or if you're playing against a perfect poker playing robot, that open limping the small blind might be more optimal than raising. But I also think it has some exploitive potential, especially because it's not a scenario that most people are accustomed to dealing with. Yeah. And I do think that there's a lot to be said for putting your opponent in, for just giving them situations that they can't learn how to play from a poker training video.
Yes.
Which right now, I don't think that there's any video or any book or anything out there that tells you how to deal with a guy who never open raises from the small blind, but will open limp a really wide range and will have a good, will do a good job of deciding whether to call or fold or three bet. That's not information that's out there. It's not experience that anyone really has. I don't think there's many people who have ever played that strategy well. It's something I fiddled around with a little bit actually a couple of years ago, but I didn't really stick with it, and I'm not going to claim that I ever did a particularly good job of implementing it. So I don't, it's just not information that's out there. So if Sauce becomes, and I think he easily could if he's not already, if Sauce becomes the best player in the world at playing in exactly that scenario, you know, he becomes better than anyone else in the world at playing when the small blind open limps, then that's a huge advantage for him to have if he can create that situation once every, let's say once every seven orbits at a six-handed table. Yeah. He's able to create that situation, and he plays that situation much better than the guy on his left. Even if it's not theoretically optimal, it may be exploitively optimal.
Yeah, especially because the right way to react to that with 100 big blind stacks is probably to bet, you know, three times the pot or twice the pot or something with a balanced range on the flop, turn, and river. Probably nobody in the world has worked out how to do that.
Yeah.
Probably nobody. I guess I've seen, you know, some of the great players do really solid and brilliant things with overbetting. So I guess I shouldn't say nobody, but certainly your average grinder is not going to be in a position to be constructing those ranges correctly. There could also be a psychological benefit. I mean, a related subject is having a very tight or even empty three betting range out of the big blind. It might have been Kirby Nader on 2+2 who talked about in Heads Up No Limit never three betting and never donk betting the flop. So he would literally, every time he was in the big blind and it was open raised, he would either fold or call and check the flop. I'm not sure that's right. And I'm also not sure it was Kirby Nader. So sorry if you're listening. I mean, it would be pretty cool if he was listening. but somebody was talking about this, and I know it was a good, successful player, right? I know that when I've had tight ranges, it just pisses people off, at least at the sort of 2-4 heads up level that I was playing at, because, you know, they want to play big pots in position, especially if they're stuck. They feel like, first, that you're this huge fish who isn't three betting enough, and second, that they're not getting the sort of action that they should be getting. And if you're playing intelligently, and if you sort of know how to handle these smaller pots and how to handle the fact that your calling range includes these stronger hands that it wouldn't otherwise have, when you combine that with your opponent's tilt, it can be very effective. And with the fact that you're putting them in a situation they don't know much about.
I was actually kind of surprised. There is a thread, I think it was in one of the heads up forums on 2+2 somewhat recently. It might have actually been in the theory forum. Someone asked the question, if one player got to always have aces and his opponent knew he always had aces, how deep would stacks have to be before that player is at a disadvantage in a heads up match? And that player was also the player out of position, which is pretty important. So this is the big blind in a heads up match. And what was surprising about this was that some players who I recognized and have been around 2+2 for a while were treating it like a ridiculous question. To be fair, there's some chance that they were like leveling or doing some of those other like cute things that people like to do on the forums. But I mean, there were people who were just like, aces always have the advantage.
Wait, does the guy with aces know that his opponent knows that he has aces?
Yes, and the other important detail is that the guy with aces is there was some rule about that he wasn't allowed to raise to just jam preflop.
I was going to say that I can think of a way to show a profit with aces.
Allowing the guy with aces to just jam preflop. I think it was that he was not allowed to raise preflop.
Okay.
So then it was just like, if you go to the flop and your opponent knows that you have aces and there's, you know, X big blinds in the pot and the effective stack sizes is Y, what X and Y have to be before that becomes an unprofitable spot for the guy with aces.
Jeez. I mean, not being allowed to raise preflop is a huge disadvantage. I mean, independently of the fact that it's aces that you can't raise with. But yeah, no, that's definitely not a crazy question.
Well, there's no reason why the opponent would ever want to raise preflop if you always have aces.
Yes.
Like the small blind is always, there's just a question of like how often he should complete versus fold from the button, but yeah. he would never raise. So then I guess you go to the flop with two big blinds in the pot, and it's a question of what, how deep do you have to be before the guy with aces can't play that well?
Yeah. No, it's tough. I mean, it's a hard math question, I think. But again, we're in the situation where optimal poker involves a lot of overbetting, which almost nobody does, right? Like, for the person without aces to get much out of the situation, he's going to have to actually use the stack that he has. And since there's not going to be a raise preflop, you know, there's only three streets. And if you want to get in 99 big blinds that you have left into a two big blind pot, you're going to have to do some pretty severe overbetting. And nobody knows how to do that. In practice, if you didn't let the guy without aces overbet, I think the aces win for any stack size. But of course,
yeah, just checking and calling pot size bets would allow you to show a profit in that case.
Well, I mean, not with the aces. Checking and calling with aces will not let you show a profit if the other person knows you have aces, right?
Yeah.
Okay. but
I mean, I guess it's checking and making a decision about whether to call or fold.
Well, I think you'll be betting a lot of flops, right? Because you'll be
best hand more often.
Yeah. So I think more aggression will be called for.
Really, that seems weird to me. If your opponent knows exactly what your hand is, it seems like it would be pretty hard for you to get him to ever make a mistake if you're betting. Like the best you can do is try to
better than giving him a free card. That's.
Oh yeah, that's true.
I mean, it's like anything else. I mean, even if your hand is face up, sometimes. I mean, this comes up more in
checking could be a bigger mistake than.
Yeah.
Like even if he's like presumably a good player is not going to make a bad call, but his call like forcing him to call could still be better for you than letting him see a free card.
Yes, I mean that makes sense. Yes. I mean, I think in theory that even with 100 big blind stack, the person without aces probably has the best of it, but that there you could probably count on one hand the number of people alive that could actually play anything even approximating the right strategy with that.
Yeah.
Crazy hypotheticals aside, are there any tangible real world things we can leave our listeners with on this subject?
Well, we haven't really even talked about post-flop play at all. We basically just explained why it may make sense from the small blind in terms of both people having, if both people are going to have wide ranges and both people are going to know that, why as the out-of-position player you'd like to avoid putting a lot of money into the pot pre-flop. I think that effect is only magnified as you get deeper into the hand.
Yes.
Your opponent's positional advantage is more valuable on more streets as they're, you know, as you make more decisions, the positional advantage compounds, and also the information advantage that your opponent has if you aren't playing this limp calling strategy. One of the big advantages of doing this is that you are giving away less information about your hand because you can open limp a wider range than you can open raise. You're providing less information about your hand from the get-go. Like all of your ranges are wider at every point in the hand as a result of doing this. And so your opponent having less precise information about your hand also is to your benefit. It makes it harder for him to use the information that he does have because that information is less valuable. And it also makes it harder for him to use his position. Like position and information are advantages that compound each other.
Yeah.
So it's harder for him to take advantage of that by putting you in tough spots after the flop based on him having some knowledge of your range. When your range is wider and contains more different types of hands, it's harder for your opponent to determine what is the, you know, what kind of play will give you tough decisions later in the hand.
That's pretty interesting. Do you think position helps you more when you have more or less information? I mean, obviously having both is a wonderful thing, but I guess I sometimes think that when I have less information, that's when it actually might benefit me more to be in position.
Well, I mean, it benefits you in that it enables you to get, like, I mean, position has multiple advantages. One of them is enabling you to get more information. And that, of course, is more valuable when you don't, the less information you have, the more valuable it is for you to be able to accumulate information from seeing what your opponent does. But I mean, just having the actual ability to act after your opponent, even independent of the informational advantage, is beneficial. Right, because you have the option to not bet and to see another card, which your opponent does not have, or the option to not raise and to see another card. So you have more control over how much money goes into the pot on any given street than your opponent does.
Yeah.
And I think that's valuable independent of any informational advantage that you get from position.
I do see the force of your original point, which is like he's going to have a hard time. I mean, certainly if you're never open raising, it's going to be hard for him to cap your range or to think that your range is capped, you know, justifiably in a lot of situations. And a lot of the times when you really get into trouble in poker is when your opponent has position on you and knows that you can't have some big category of hands. So it does keep you out of those kinds of trouble spots. If I were in the sort of situation where I would be playing a never open raise strategy, I would also be disinclined to lead out on the flop. Like when it went complete check, I guess by the time my opponent checks, my range is probably slightly stronger than his is.
I think your range is quite a bit stronger than his is once he checks.
Yeah, yeah.
You have 100% of hands, and we've said that he should be raising something like the top 50% of hands.
Well,
or not necessarily the top, but he should be raising 50% of hands, including most of his strong hands most of the time. So I would think 100% is stronger than like
75%.
Oh yeah, yeah. Sorry, yeah. So your like top 70% range is going to be stronger than his like middling 50% range.
His third quartile range or something. Right. Well, I guess not that. His third and fourth quartile range.
Yeah.
So that's right. So I guess here we have some reasons to lead out fairly often, namely that your range is a lot stronger, and some reasons not to, which is that you're out of position.
This, I think, is actually very similar to the conversation we had last week about continuation betting when you're out of position.
Yes.
I think it's a pretty similar spot where even if you know that your range is stronger than your opponent's, the fact that they have position on you can limit the effectiveness of blindly continuation betting.
Yes.
Which, you know, I still think continuation betting aggressively is important. I think there's... You don't necessarily want to bet 100% of your range on every flop, but I would be surprised if like auto checking the flop is correct.
Yeah, I mean, if it comes down like ace jack six, it would be hard for me to see reasons why you should not be betting 1.3 big blinds with plenty of value hands and some other semi bluffing hands, just because he should be raising so many of his Broadway hands.
Yeah.
And you've got all those in your range, so.
And I mean, and that's also the reason why he shouldn't always raise those hands.
Yes.
So that you can't make determinations like that about his range.
But, yes.
I mean, some of them should still be possible, actually.
But I mean, even if he does it sometimes, you still have so many more of them that, I mean, who cares?
All he's doing is like cutting his losses. He's not making it unprofitable for you. He's just making it less damaging.
Yeah. So certainly, I think on certain flop textures, I guess I'm going to, now that I've thought about it, contradict what I said earlier, and you really will just have to lead out on a bunch of flops with a bunch of hands.
This actually is pretty similar to another spot that you brought up last week, which is in triple draw. I think the idea, and I'm not much of a triple draw player, so please correct me if this is wrong, but I think the received wisdom or the adage that I've heard is that if you draw fewer cards than your opponent, then you should bet the next street.
Yeah.
So, and this is the same thing. It's like, because your range going into the hand, going into the street is stronger. And I mean, no limit or hold'em is a little bit different because you get the extra information of seeing the flop, and you know that the flop, because they're community cards, they affect your opponent as well. Whereas in triple draw, the card that you draw hardly affects your opponent at all.
Yes.
So, I mean, there's that extra bit of information, but generally, like, the fact that you have a stronger range than he does coming into the street is a strong argument, not necessarily a 100% the way it is in triple draw, but it's a strong argument for you betting whatever happens on this street and what flops.
The key ingredients of the triple draw situation are, first, that being a card ahead is such a huge advantage, and second, that you're playing a limit game. Like, what are you going to do? Like, raise me one bet? I'm shaking in my shoes here, you know? So, I mean, here you do have the complications that flop texture and the no-limit structure present to you. Against a perfect computer, they're going to put you in really tough spots by overbetting, but almost no human beings do that. So, certainly a good first instinct to have is that once your opponents reveal themselves to be weak, and you know yourself to have a much stronger range, just bet and lock up your equity.
Mm.
Let's see. So we've talked about preflop, talked about some flop stuff. I guess check raising might make less sense.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the continuation betting analogy is really strong here, even though you didn't raise, even though we're talking about a scenario where you didn't raise preflop, I think this is still very analogous to the very common question of like whether to continuation bet on the flop. And I mean, I would say it's not never correct to check raise the preflop raiser, but it's not something that I end up doing all that often. And I think that's pretty simple. Like, because we're saying that you should have a pretty wide bluffing range in this spot, I think that you also need a lot of your value hands to be betting hands.
Yeah.
As opposed to the hands that you try to check raise.
Yeah. Of course, one thing your opponent might do is to try to strengthen up his checking behind range preflop. And of course, if he does that, you should adjust to it. But notice that if he does that, then you win. You've accomplished something magnificent and wonderful, which is, you know, to get him to check behind with good hands and let the pot stay at two big blinds when he has position. I mean, that would be awesome if you can get him to do that. So I think some people will do that, but I think when they have, they've given up so much to you that the limping strategy has already been a success.
Yeah.
Good.
I'm actually a little worried that I'm going to look back on this or someone's going to say something that's going to make me feel stupid for something that I said. Because I think like actually sitting down with tools like Poker Stove and an old fashioned pen and pencil or pen and paper or a calculator or something. And actually, because a lot of this is, if not solvable by mathematics, at least estimatable.
Yes.
By actually doing some work that we haven't done that I'm not real inclined to do right now. So I think there's some chance that we'll be made to look foolish. But I would encourage people to do that. You know, I hope that you may need to, you know, listen to this a few times, but I think it's pretty valuable to be able to ask questions like this. We tried to point to some of the ways in which this has real immediate practical applications at the table, but I do think that just learning to understand what we're talking about and why it's important will do a lot towards increasing your ability to think independently about poker.
And I do think we've given, I mean, if your goal is to make money in the short and medium term and not to construct a perfect computer, I do think we've said things that'll help also in terms of why you would want to do this and what sorts of playing advantages you could expect to be gaining and giving up in return and things like that. Elwood, longtime player, former professional, all-around good guy, and author of Reading Poker Tells, the book we've been talking about.
Zach, you're joining us from Portland now?
Yeah, Portland, Oregon. That's right.
And you're not a professional poker player at the moment, but you are still playing sometimes in games in the Portland area?
Yeah, I still play, not nearly as much as I'd like to. I'm working a full-time job and just got married recently, so that is a factor too. Yeah, but all that means, and I've been working on some other projects too, like, you know, the book obviously took a lot of my time.
Sure.
And I'm working on something else right now, so all that stuff going on, I don't find as much time as I'd like to play, you know, like I used to. I kind of miss, and I'm glad I'm not playing as much as I used to, but I'd like to at least play like a quarter or half as much as I used to, but maybe one day soon.
What's the poker scene like in Portland? I mean, they don't have legal poker rooms in the city, do they?
They do. It's kind of an interesting phenomenon, really. I've kind of, you know, I moved here kind of to get away from the poker scene. I moved here from Albuquerque, where I was playing for a living there. And, you know, and I moved here like 2007, and there really wasn't much in Portland for poker. But then slowly they basically found a loophole where they found out if you set it up as a social club, then you could have poker here. And there was the first challenge for that was you could only be tournaments, but they also found kind of a loophole with that in that they structure these games, they call them tournaments, and they structure them sort of like tournaments. But basically it's like, you know, they do the equivalent of an equity chop at any time. So anybody can cash out after a certain amount of time.
Right.
And they treat it, you know, basically it runs like a cash game. And
yeah.
So
unlimited, you know, rebuys, blinds go up every 12 hours.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Something like that, where it's like, it's, you know, it's basically a cash game. And, but they found these interesting loopholes. So like, since I've moved here, I mean, there was basically nothing in Portland. You had to drive, you know, at least 45 minutes to play some, decent stakes poker. But now they've got, you know, like, I mean, there's been like 10 that have opened up that I know of. Some of them probably closed by now, but, you know, some of them are doing quite well and offering the equivalent of 1-2 and 2-5, no limit, and maybe even bigger for all I know in some places, but I haven't really researched it. But Yeah, you know, a lot of good tournaments. Like, you know, you can find $100 plus buy-in tournaments, you know, several times a week. And so, yeah, it's kind of grown up around me as I move here, and it's been kind of interesting to see it progress. But yeah, that's the kind of the state it's at now.
That's convenient. And you feel like you haven't lost your chops. You're still feeling competitive when you sit down to play.
Well, I noticed, like, psychologically, I feel like fundamentally my game's really good, and I really like my game, but I think my main weakness is when I haven't played for a while, when I get back out there, I'm much more gambly than I need to be. Mm. I'm a pretty aggressive player to begin with, and I can usually, you know, I'm using it smartly. I, you know, use that when I should use it, but a lot of times, if I've played in a while, I kind of go out there thinking like, oh, I just really want to, you know, more of the gamble mentality than there should be, you know, for a smart poker player. And
yeah, and you kind of think, well, if I'm only going to play a couple hours this week, I want to make them count. You know, I want to make sure I get a nice score.
And it's like, you know, it's kind of like it's like just the enjoyment of the game. When you haven't played in a while, you're kind of like want to play more, and you want to get in more hands more, and you're kind of like, you know, ends up biting me in the ass. So that's kind of like where I found myself. I know when I'm playing bad, and I still like my game a lot. When I go out, I usually do well.
Well, the book that you wrote, Reading Poker Tales, obviously is a lot about making live reads on players. You feel like that's a pretty big part of the edge that you have in the games, is your ability to read people?
I don't want to overstate it, but it's, you know, like I say in the book, I think you can add like 10 to 20%, depending on the game you're in, to your edge, to your profit. And I feel like, you know, when you're, especially, you know, if I'm playing these games I'm playing around here, especially like the $100 around $100 plus buy-in tournaments, and the 1-2 or the 2-5, whatever, are so weak that they're giving away a lot of information. Otherwise, it wouldn't be the case if I was playing in harder games. You know, it'd be harder to find some of those obvious things. But you know, the more unskilled your opposition, the more it can.
You don't think that you can calculate the equity of knowing a particular tell down to the penny, like Mike Caro does in Caro's Book of Poker Tells?
Need a very large database, and I have better things to do. You know, it's just such a ridiculous thing to try to calculate when you factor in like how many different types of games there are and how many different types of players there are. You know, it's just such a silly idea.
It's got to be the most. I mean, it's a good book, but it's got to be the most ridiculous thing about it.
Yeah, I did. That was one of the things that I liked about your book, Zach, relative to a lot of the poker books that are out there, was that I didn't feel like you were really overclaiming the importance of the information. You know, it wasn't subtitled like how to crush every poker game you ever sit down in or anything like that. I mean, there's a lot of helpful information in the book, but I didn't feel like you were trying to sell it as a magic bullet or something that's just going to magically cause you to win the next World Poker Tour event or something, which I feel like a lot of poker books are both marketed that way, and it seems like some of the authors may actually believe that that kind of thing is in the book, and I respect that you didn't go that route.
Right, and I felt a moral responsibility kind of to do that, because I just know that it's easy to fall into those kinds of languages, I think, and you see that a lot with when people promote their stuff, and I felt a real responsibility because I knew that there'd be a lot of fairly inexperienced players reading this book, and I didn't want them to get the wrong impression. So I wanted to make sure that they knew, you know, this isn't something that's magic. The much more important stuff is the strategic fundamentals. You know, that stuff's so much more important. And I didn't want to do a disservice to them and make them think, oh, you know, it's all about tells, you know. So that was my goal. And I spent a lot of time actually on the language of the book, because I really wanted to accurately, you know, give tells their give them whatever, but I didn't want to overstate them to the point where it was unrealistic, you know. So that was kind of the balance I tried to strike in the book, and, you know, also keeping in mind that, you know, there's no one size fits all aspect to tells. You know, it's mostly about just examining specific players, even though there might be common, you know, common patterns amongst players. But
yeah, what was your motivation for wanting to write a book about tells in the first place?
Well, I've always been interested in psychology. I considered, you know, when I ended up going to school for video and film. But I considered psychology. I've just always been interested in reading about it and studying people. And, you know, then when I got into poker, which was, you know, I kind of started playing and reading poker in around 2000 when I was in college and playing some games in college. And and setting up games and stuff and getting more into it. And I started, I would take notes on the players I played with and take notes on, not just their strategic tendencies, but also their tells, and try to make, correlations between what they were doing in certain hands. And so that continued over the years. When I started playing for a living in around 2004, I kept doing that and was always interested. I think the idea for the book kind of probably came along around that time, or a couple years later, towards the end of when I was playing for a living. And I just it took me several years to keep that in my mind and keep thinking like, I think there's a place for a better book about tells out there, because I just didn't think that the books that were out there had done service to the complexities of, of the body language and behavior that you see at the poker table. So it was always an ongoing, kind of an interest and project that I'd kept in my mind for years.
I was curious, so you recently moved from New Mexico to Portland. Do you find regional differences in the manifestations of tells and the significance of them?
I didn't, but, it was, I don't think it's that big a move. But, I don't have much experience on it, but I am curious how, say if I went to Macau, would I see some different tendencies that are based on cultural differences? I hear some stories about how there's different behavioral patterns and stuff in other cultures, but I haven't experienced it myself. Although I have, I have noticed some things from a racial perspective, but I probably shouldn't go into them. It's not that it's, politically incorrect or anything. It's just I would be speculating, because these are kind of ideas that I've noticed and wondered if they had some correlation, from a cultural perspective or something. But I haven't really delved into it too much. But
yeah, interesting. It's one really nice thing about your book is that you, when you get down to talking about specific behaviors, you're good about focusing on the motive and psychological interpretation for a certain behavior. And, as you move around the country, at least I found different people in a room often, different card rooms are often full of people who are playing for quite different reasons. And that leads to differences in betting behavior and tells. And it might be interesting if you see some of these things develop over time. But if you don't, then maybe I've been wrong about that all along. So.
Sense. I mean, yeah, like, example, you might have, a card room in one place where it's mostly a lot of retired, rich type players, and in another place it might be a lot of, young kids who, play online poker, and they're playing for much more, serious reasons or whatever. Yeah, I think you're right that there's going to be different groups of people, which, and so it would make sense that they have different tendencies. And I'm sure that, one thing I say about my book and myself is like, I don't pretend to be an expert on this stuff. I'm just somebody who's studied it a lot. And I think, really I could study a lot more, or somebody else could study a lot more and probably find, many more interesting correlations. But, and I really think it's, in a lot of ways it's just barely scratching the surface, because it's hard to scientifically study these things,
Although it seems like some of the literature that you were referring to in the book is, I mean, you do reference like Mike Caro, but you also talked some about, people who look at behavioral science outside of a poker context, right
they do, but poker is just such a unique environment. I mean, if you could, like, Paul Ekman is the guy who, I've read a lot about him, and he's a noted, really respected behavioral psychologist who's made a lot of correlations between, certain facial expressions or body language or whatever to certain mental states. But, if you were to take his scientific abilities and, get him to do a study at a, in a poker game, a real poker game that he could observe, over time, like control it scientifically and everything, I'm sure you could, find some really interesting things and have quantifiable, results to show. And that's actually been something I've thought about, setting up more in a more scientific atmosphere, like setting up a real poker game where the stakes, were meaningful to the people, and recording, you could record so many things that, would be interesting that you just can't observe, like the stuff they would record on lie detector test, you know, set up like skin conductivity
and
kind of stuff. And there'd be, you know, pupil dilation, you know, if you scientifically set that up and see how people react differently when they bluff versus when they're value betting, et cetera. You know, you could find, I have no doubt you could find such interesting information that would have statistical significance, you know. And but, you know, that's, nobody's done it yet. Maybe I'll do it first. I don't know.
Well, you got to figure too, though, that's going to be a case of the people knowing that they're being monitored is certainly going to change their behavior. I mean, it's hard to ignore the fact that you have all that stuff clipped to you. And I would have to think that it's going to change a little bit the way that you respond when you're trying to like play poker in a laboratory setting, I would think.
Yeah, exactly. And that's a whole other factor. And that's, you know, that's another reason why I say it's hard to study this kind of thing, you know, just like it's hard to make any really good psychological studies for exactly those reasons, you know. You know, and that, you know, it's enough for me right now to try to take notes and note where I see, you know, tendencies. But I really think, you know, there's many people that observe people probably much better than I do. I've just kind of devoted a lot of just brute force attention to it. Whereas I don't think I'm like a skilled observer of people. It's just more like intellectual effort.
Well, I was curious because we were talking about, or I said that you had mentioned Mike Caro specifically in the book. And one of the things that I like about your book is that you do reference other authors who have written on the subject, which is another thing that you actually don't see that often. Even though most poker authors are treading ground that other people have written on before, you very rarely see an author just come right out and say, you know, here's what this previous author had to say about this subject, and here's why I agree or disagree, or here's why I think what I'm saying is a little bit different from what he's saying. And I like that you were doing that a lot with Caro's book. And it jumped out at me that I don't think you mentioned, and now I can't even think of his name, Navarro. I don't think you mentioned Navarro's book. I assume you did read that.
Yeah, I did reference to him in the very end, right? Where I was saying, talking to myself and my reasons for writing the book, but yeah, I really didn't reference him because I don't really, honestly, I don't like his work. I think most of his stuff is just really general behavioral, you know, analysis of human behavior, but I don't think it's.
Yeah, I mean, he's not really a poker player. I mean, he was the FBI agent who decided to apply those skills to poker, but I don't know how much of a poker player he really is.
Because, you know, he had a book out before the Poker Tell book came out. It was just a general book, you know, like how to read when people are lying and that kind of stuff. And I think what happened was he met Annie Duke and Phil Hellmuth through some, you know, some TV publicity thing they were doing. And they were like, you know, we should get him to partner with him on this tell book because he could take, you know, that same language he used in this other general book and put it in the tell book. And I think that's pretty much what happened. And they made sold some copies of it that way just because there wasn't much else in the market. But really I honestly have a lot of problems with how that book was done because I just don't, I flat out disagree with a good amount of the stuff in there. And I think it's, you know, he also has that problem of overstating how important these things are because
that was one of the main people I had in mind when I was making those comments.
It just shows a real fundamental amateur, you know, viewpoint of what the important things in poker are. You know, a lot of fishy people who don't know much about poker are gonna talk about it's all about tells, you know, it's all about reading people, and that's one of the reasons I'm kind of self-conscious whenever I talk about it with people because, you know, because so many of the things you hear people talk about tells are usually from people who just don't have a clue about what they're talking about.
Yeah.
I mean, I think Navarro knows a lot of stuff, but some of his approach is definitely geared as a sales approach. I think he tries to claim that there are like specific isolatable behaviors that mean the same thing sort of cross-culturally, across everything. And it's, I think that's a big mistake. And yeah, I just can't imagine that he has the kind of data that he needs to back up that assertion. And I think I have a lot of data that just straightforwardly shows it's false. So, I thought your book was better than that.
I agree with a lot of what you said there. And I've been planning on writing an article about the specific things I found wrong with the book, you know, because some of the things he stated I thought were true from a general psychology perspective, but didn't apply at the poker table. And I could go into a lot of detail about that. But basically, I think it's just because you know, the difference between interrogating someone is a much different environment than poker table, obviously, and there's going to be differences in how people react under pressure there.
And bluffing isn't exactly the same as lying.
Yeah, exactly. There's things that are just unique. And like, one of the things is, I think he, you know, I'll do it really shortly. Like, one of the major things I had a problem with in those books, or when he talks about tells, is, you know, he talked about these signs of distress signs, you know, or indicators of distress, which are like, you know, put hands on your eyebrows or squeezing your neck or whatever it is, these little signs of distress. But and he says they're indicators of bluffing. But in my experience, you just won't see, you won't hardly ever see bluffers do that kind of stuff, because we all instinctively know what those kinds of stress indicators look like. So if anything, the bluffers are avoiding those kind of behaviors because they instinctively know it looks weak.
Right.
You know, there were a lot of things that had to do with that in the book, and but I'll just leave it at that for now. But just to give an example of what I disagreed with, and
yeah, and even that specific example, I think, as you pointed out, is wrong. I mean, if I had to make one guess about somebody who's massaging the back of his neck, I would think that he's somebody who's gotten into a big pot with aces and doesn't know if the other guy made a set or something like that, but he's just nervous and doesn't know what to do. But it doesn't at all mean that he's bluffing. Like, that's there are all sorts of reasons to, yeah.
And a lot of it depends on the situation. It's like, you know, you'll see a guy giving signs of distress when he knows he's not going to raise and he's just thinking about folding. You know, he's either thinking about folding or calling, and that's what it really struck me about Navarro when he was trying to analyze people who were obviously just thinking about either folding or calling. You know, they weren't going to be raising or playing anymore, you know. They were looking at a big bet on the river and deciding whether to call or fold. And of course, in that situation, players aren't going to care about what signs of distress they give off, because everyone knows, you know, they don't care if everybody knows whether they had a hard decision or not.
Right. Yeah.
I've seen some episodes of WSOP where Navarro is trying to analyze that information. I was like, yeah, that doesn't make any sense. Like, yeah. you know, that's not meaningful information at that point. You know, if there's no more action.
Yeah, it's sort of like talking about whether it's correct to raise with an overpair. You know, like without further context, it's not really a meaningful question.
Right.
What do you advise? I mean, for people who are new to looking for tells at the poker table, where do you suggest that they start? I mean, you give a lot of information about different things to look for, and I feel like it could probably be pretty overwhelming for someone who's new to trying to spot any of this stuff.
Well, first, I'd say, you know, I think for most people, you know, most people are just not good enough fundamentally. I think honestly, it's the most important thing people could do is brush up on their fundamental strategies and study more. But you know, if someone's dedicated to looking for tells and they think they have a good handle, you know, have a good handle on the strategy part, and
someone like me who's maybe has been a successful online poker player but somewhat inexperienced in the live arena.
Right. Yeah. Well, yeah. Ideally,
I'm looking for free coaching here, basically.
Like you said, ideally, yeah, you're a winning player who wants to try to get some extra edges on people. Yeah, that would be ideal. I would say the most important thing to start looking for is, and I could probably make a list of this. I think I have before, but I'm not sure it's on my blog. But the first thing I look for is watching people in the significant pots. You know, I watch people like when when I'm not involved or when I'm involved, whichever. I watch people when they're in the significant pots, like turn or river bets. And I try to, first thing I look for is the eye contact stuff. Like how, what do they look after they bet? You know, are they looking at the opponent? Are they looking down the table? And hopefully you can get some correlations. You know, if the hands get shown down, you can get some correlation on whether they had a hand, strong hand, a weak hand, what was going on there. So you try to correlate. Yeah, the eye contact is really big for me. That's one of the things I try to look for the most, because there's usually going to be patterns with most people, unless they're completely stoic and just always looking at the same place. But most people have some sort of pattern, like whether it's like how loose their eyes move around, and also the physical movement is really big too. Like, and this is all post-bet information. Like, this is all stuff I'd be studying after the person has bet, because that's much more stressful spot than, you know, waiting for somebody to bet or whatever. So I'd be looking at, you know, movement, how much do they move around after they bet in a significant spot, how much eye contact do they make, where do they look, you know, even when it comes to physical movements, like how loose are their fingers, what are they doing with their fingers, are they shuffling chips, not shuffling chips, do their fingers or arms seem really still, or is there a lot of like random little movements that you might have otherwise missed if you weren't looking at it really closely. So it's a lot of that stuff. The post bet stuff is really important, and usually where I concentrate a lot of action, a lot of attention, and yeah, and also the indications of folding behind you. I think that's another really big one. You know, just studying how people hold their cards or their chips or whatever behind you, like pre-flop when it's the action's coming around. So if you can get a sense, you know, that somebody's folding or intending to play, that can kind of dictate your strategy in some cases. You know, whether you make a a loose raise or whatever you do. Yeah, so I'd say those are some of the more important ones.
How about in terms of which players at the table to pay attention to first? I feel like I've heard conflicting opinions on that. Some people say watch the player on your left, watch the player on your right, watch the weakest player at the table. Where do you suggest if people are just trying to keep track of what the meaning of two or three people's body language if they don't feel like they can track nine people at once?
Yeah, that's a real good question. I actually, if I could do it over again, I would have included a few paragraphs about this in the book, if I could go back. But it's a real good question. Because it is so easy to get overwhelmed by all this information. You know, it's just so much information, and you want to just limit your efforts to the most important information. So when I sit down, I the person I'm most likely to study first is the loosest player, because they're going to be in the most pots. So that's assuming that they're, you know, that they're somewhat bad, or as long as they're not, you know, super good. If it was a super good lag in there, I probably wouldn't spend too much effort if I knew that they were really good. But, you know, most players aren't when you get down to it. So there's value to studying the loosest players just because they'll be in the pot more. After that, I would say the people behind you, because, you know, they're the people that can most affect or most dangerous to you. You know, they act after you. So if you can get some reliable reads on what they look like, if they're going to enter a pot, or if they're going to, you know, if you think they're like getting chips together, like a honest loading of chips for betting or whatever the tell is that you might have on them, or like looking away when there's a lot of action and they have a strong hand, stuff like that, whatever thing you can get on them, it's going to help you. Those are the situations that are going to help you the most if you get into large pots, and also those people, can sometimes be easier, you know, just easier to see if depending on how the table is situated too. But yeah, if I was going to focus on the most important, it would be, yeah, the loosest players. It can be very difficult to gather information if somebody's just new to it. I would say, you know, I've often just picked two players and tried to just completely concentrate on them. You know, that's often much more effective than trying to like spread out your attention over the whole table, because much more, you know, you learn much more about specific player.
I've found myself gravitating towards people just if I think there's more to be observed there, regardless of where a player is sitting. If it seems like he is not paying particularly much attention to trying to keep a poker face, or it seems like there'd be a particularly big payoff just because he's giving away more information with his body language than some other people are. I'll sometimes, because I'm one of these people, I don't feel like I can track nine people all that effectively. So I kind of try to see who's giving away the most information with their body language and keep an eye on that person, especially if it's someone where I also have a good view of that person at the table. Like I sometimes have trouble watching the person on my immediate right without real obviously staring at them.
Right. That's a really good point. Yeah. I should have mentioned that too. Yeah. If you see someone who's varying their behavior a lot, or doing things out of the ordinary a lot, you know, if you see a lot of variety in their actions, that would be a great person to start studying, you know. Like you said, that's a good.
One thing I kind of expected you to say that you should be looking at the people with the most money. And I know one thing you emphasize in the book is using tells for big river decisions. And you might think that if you think that that's where tells are the most useful, then you might want to focus the most on the guy with the most money. Or maybe I've just been playing too many uncapped games lately.
Yeah, that's a really good point too. I mean, yeah, I mean that's a really good idea too. You know, there's obviously a lot of factors, but yeah, you could set a really bad player who does a lot of crazy things and he's got a big stack and he's right behind you. That would be ideal. All these factors that you could pick out, you know, and I guess a lot of it depends on what you feel comfortable with. It's like, yeah, a lot of it will just depend on how much information you're getting from that person. So if you know, if there's a guy with a large stack, yeah, that's a good point. Study him. And if there's somebody you're studying and you can't get any information from them, which will happen a lot, then just move on to somebody else. And, don't waste too much time if it's too much of a challenge to, get a read on someone, because it's not always going to happen.
How blatantly are you examining people? I mean, are you just going to turn and like stare somebody down like a deer in headlights looking for information? Do you feel like people sort of give away less when they know that they're being watched? Do you try to be more subtle about it?
I probably don't pick up as much as I could because of that, but I kind of have a conflict about it, because really I think wearing sunglasses is really the ideal way to study people, but I always feel like kind of an ass when I wear sunglasses. So this kind of conflict, like, ideally I would really just love to wear sunglasses so nobody would know where I was looking and I could study people at my leisure, but then I always end up, usually, unless I'm playing in a big tournament or something, I don't wear them. So I think I actually miss out on a lot of information just because I do like to do a more indirect studying, because I don't want to alert people to the fact that I'm studying. So I kind of like use my peripheral vision a lot. I kind of take glances at them at certain times, and I don't want to alert them to the fact I'm studying. I think, for me that works. I think other people could have certain more confrontational styles, like I think of Ben Lamb and the final table, or, how he plays involves a lot of staring. I don't know if he's doing that just for, is he looking for tells? Is he intimidating people out of making moves on him? I'm not sure his motivations, but if somebody had that kind of style and was very observant, that could be very powerful too, but that's just not my style.
Did you watch the final table this year?
I didn't watch all of it. I watched mainly the last, the heads up portion and a little bit before that. Yeah.
All right. I thought Balsinger was giving away a lot of information. Do you agree with that?
He could have been. I didn't really analyze it that much. I thought he had something where he was making too much eye contact when he was strong, I think, like after betting. I can't remember. I think it was eye contact related, maybe when he was strong or weak. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I couldn't tell you exactly what it was, but I thought he looked different sometimes when he was value betting and when he was bluffing. Like, I definitely turned to my wife a couple times and I said, like, oh, okay, now I definitely think he's bluffing. I mean, it helped that the betting patterns reinforced that.
You could, it's very well true. If I had time, I'd like to go back and study his, because I only mainly watch like the three-handed and the heads up, and I bet if you went back and really did a study of his value bets versus bluffs, I'm sure you'd see something would pop out at you. Did you guys read the P.S. Hines blog post I did?
I have not, to be honest.
I'll send you, it's on my blog, but I'll send you guys a link to it. But I thought it was, I was really proud of that one, because it was, I thought it gave a really good it showed a really statistically significant tell that P.S. Hines had, and it had to do with eye contact. And I thought I had enough points of reference where you could see it was a really statistically significant tell when he was strong.
That's cool. I'll put that in the show notes as well, so the listeners can find it.
Yeah, that was my favorite blog, because I spent a lot of time going through the footage and saying, oh, let's compare all these points. And it was kind of time consuming to do, but I wanted to make it pretty convincing, because I was pretty sure it was significant, and then it turned to be a nice article.
Do you play the WSOP, or have you?
No, I never have. Yeah, never have. I only just started fairly recently playing tournaments. When I played for a living, I basically played zero tournaments. So I like them a lot.
Do you find differences in tells between cash games and tournaments?
Yeah, definitely. There's much more of the emotion-based tells in tournaments, just because there's so much, nobody wants to get knocked out and leave, and everybody's, if you get knocked out and leave, you might leave with nothing. So that, everybody's gunning for that big prize. So there's a lot more of those kind of, anxiety producing tells, and I see more of them than in a cash game, whereas, a lot of people in cash games don't really, don't care as much about that particular moment,
I was curious also, we talked about using sunglasses as a way to conceal the fact that you're watching people, but some of the ways that you talk about picking up tells on people are also based on getting them to talk or trying to engage them a little bit in conversation. Do you do anything similar? I mean, do you talk constantly so that people can't tell when you're feeling them out for information? Because I feel like otherwise it sort of comes out of left field. If I haven't spoken for an hour and then all of a sudden I start asking a guy like, what do you have? What do you want me to do? Should I fold? Should I call? I think it feels too much like I'm interrogating him and people don't give me as much information.
I would say if I'm going to be asking questions like that, I don't usually talk that much when I play. Occasionally, you know, I'll do something weird or try to get some information, but it's not very often. And usually it's, you know, if I'm going to ask someone something or try to interact with them in order to get some information, it's usually going to be like in a river bet situation where they've bet and I'm going to try to get some information, you know, where I think it's a borderline decision. You know, it's not very often though. And sometimes I do stupid stuff where, like, recently I was just talking way too much when I had made a big bluff in like a $500 pot. And I basically just talked this guy into calling, I think it would have worked with a lot of other players, honestly, but I think I just was much too fancy because I went against my own advice, which is just shut the hell up when you're bluffing. You know, that's basically my advice because most people are just going to do what they're going to do. And sometimes people are just going to call you cause you're talking, you know? So I think that's what happened in this case where I was like, I was trying to do some like reverse psychology on this guy because I thought he was pretty decent and might go for it, but it just was a stupid idea. I think he just thought about it and was like, "Why is this guy talking so much?" I'm gonna call him. I think that kind of stuff can blow up in your face, but as long as you have an idea and know what the factors are that might influence it. You know, people have a calling tendency a lot of times, so you have to. If you're the one betting and talking, you have to factor that into account. Otherwise, if you're the one thinking about calling or thinking about whatever folding, there's not much of a downside to talking in that instance, right?
What were the games like in New Mexico? I mean, what's the poker scene like there?
Well, I can't speak for today because I was there at the boom of it, I guess, during the poker boom, you know, right after. And there was, when I first moved there, there weren't many games going on, really.
The casinos, are they mostly Indian casinos?
Yeah, Indian casinos. There's a few. The main one is Sandia. When I was there, the main one was Sandia Casino. And they have a big poker room, but there weren't that many games going on when I first moved there. And then, like, I saw it, you know, kind of really get pretty crazy there. It got really popular. There were a lot of people playing the game, stakes going up. There were more and more games. And people were having home games and stuff. It was just a big scene, grew up really quickly. I kind of grew up with it because when I was playing recreationally when I first moved there, I was playing like limit and playing some low limit online. And then I met some poker playing friends and they kind of got me more into, you know, more comfortable playing high stakes. So I started playing more and more. And I'd always been taking it, you know, pretty seriously, reading books and whatnot for years, but I hadn't made the step to playing higher stakes and playing higher limits and playing no limit and stuff like that.
Did you start working on the book while you were still a professional player, or was that just a project you decided to do after you had gotten a job?
It was it had been in my mind for years, probably like towards the end of when I was playing for a living. You know, it kind of been just stirring around in my mind for the last, you know, however long that's been, 7 years or something now. Yeah, all I had were notes that I had taken. I had taken notes and written out some interesting hands, you know, like anecdotally. But I wasn't thinking I was going to necessarily write a book. It was more like I might do a blog or something at some point. That's what I was thinking back then.
What did you find to be the biggest challenges of writing a book?
Really the organization and the phrasing. I mean, just the way to lay out a book like this, because, you know, I probably had within the first few months, like, of everything I wanted to say, but then it was just so disorganized and hard to read. You know, I spent like, you know, a year and a half just organizing it and putting it in simple language, because, you know, it's the kind of thing where it's like, you can, as soon as I wrote something, it would seem fine. Then I go back a few days later and be like, oh, what am I even trying to say here? I don't know. And, you know, trying to put it in simple language, that was a good balance of like not talking too down to experienced players and not talking too complicated for, you know, fairly inexperienced players, and also trying to pick out the most relevant information, because I had a lot more originally had a lot more things I wanted to include, but the more I thought about them and looked at them, I was like, oh, this, you know, this is probably really arguable stuff and probably, you know, stuff you wouldn't see very often, even though you might see it. So I didn't want to put stuff in there that I would kind of be more arguable. So I tried to whittle it down to the stuff I felt was like the most relevant and the most likely to be seen. And so that way it would be a more useful tool, you know, and not just go on for 100 extra pages.
It's interesting you say that, because I actually think the organization is certainly one of the stronger points of your book relative to other poker books, which I guess is not the highest standard in the world to compare it to. But I mean, I feel like a lot of poker books are just sort of a regurgitation of information. Even if it's good information, it's usually just sort of thrown out there. And I did feel like there was a logic to your book in terms of you having things organized with the post bet action and the during bet action and the pre action, or people watching you before action has taken place. I felt like there was sort of a logical thesis and organization to your information, which is more than I'm used to seeing in other poker books.
Thanks. Yeah, that was my goal. I mean, I wanted the structure of the book to kind of like represent how, you know, how I thought about it in my head, like, you know, kind of a analog to how it should be structured in your head when you observe people. So the more I could match that structure of the book to, you know, how that information might be in your head, the more that was my goal, because I thought the book should represent the structure of the information.
Well, you have future poker aspirations. Do you see yourself continuing to drive income from poker, or is it just becoming more and more of a hobby for you?
I would like to play more in the future. Like, ideally, you know, a balance of, you know, working, doing some writing related stuff, non-related to poker. If I could find a balance of non-poker related writing and then playing poker, split my time between them, I think that would be like my ideal lifestyle. Because otherwise, I don't like, you know, playing poker for a living is stressful, and especially more so these days, I think.
It's tough too if the biggest game you can find is 2-5.
Yeah, I wouldn't do it here. If I was gonna make a go at it, I'd go somewhere else. But ideally, you know, I'd like to split my time between those two. You know, so it'd be sort of a job, sort of a hobby. But I think I don't plan on writing a poker book in the near future. Probably not ever. But I am working on a DVD version of my book right now that I think will be pretty cool. Might even be better than the book. I think that video is just such a, you know, video is such a better way to show these kinds of things.
Yeah, I feel like there's a lot of poker content available on DVD that doesn't really need to be on a DVD, but I can see why the information on Tails would actually be relevant to that media.
Yeah, and this is really hard to put together too, because I've been working really hard on the best way to like script this and communicate it and set it up and all that. So
the chance to use your degree though, right?
Yeah, my video film degree. Yeah, I'm pretty out of the loop on that stuff, though. I think I'm still gonna, you know, have to hire a videographer and lighting and all that stuff. So
yeah,
but have a little bit of knowledge.
Nate, anything else you want to ask?
No, thank you guys. Anytime you want to talk again, we can do it.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Thanks, Zach.
Cool.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks, Zach. Good talking to you.
A big thank you again to Zach for coming on the show and talking about poker with us. If you're interested in his book, you can check it out at readingpokertells.com. And of course, thank you and Happy New Year to all the listeners. Have a good week.